And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. And let me start out by wishing all my listeners a happy Thanksgiving. In spite of the pandemic and the lockdowns and all this other, you can still have an enjoyable Thanksgiving. As I've said in several of my shows, there's a number of places that can actually give you a very nice Thanksgiving meal. We ordered our turkey package, as it's called, from Golden Corral. And let me tell you, it was outstanding. And if you want to order meals, I highly recommend going to Golden Corral and asking for Justin. All right, November 26th is the 330th day of the year, and leap year is 331st day. 35 days remain till this year is over with. Well, on this date in history, in 783, the Asturian queen at Osinda is held in a monastery to prevent her kin from retaking the throne from Morogatas. In 1161, the Battle of Kaishi. A Song Dynasty fleet fights a naval engagement with the Jin Dynasty ships on the Yangtze River during the Jin Song Wars. 1476, Vlad the Impaler, who many say is the individual upon whom Count Dracula is based, defeats Basharib Laota with the help of Stephen the Great and Stephen V Bathory, becomes a ruler of Wallachia for the third time. Wallachia, of course, is in Transylvania, and Bathory, one of the most famous members of that family, was the Elizabeth Bathory, who was a countess, a member of the nobility, and she discovered, according to legend, that bathing in the blood of virgins could keep you young, so she started killing off her staff. She wound up, as I understand it, being walled into her apartment in her family castle and spent the remainder of her days there. All right, 1778, in Hawaiian Islands, Captain James Cook becomes the first European to visit Maui. Weren't many souvenir stands in those days, but he picked up a few souvenirs, I understand. 1789, a National Thanksgiving Day is observed in the U.S. as proclaimed by President Washington at the request of Congress. 1805, official opening of Thomas Telford's Pontificalic Aqueduct. 1812, the Battle of Berezina begins with Napoleon's retreat from Russia. 1863, President Abraham Lincoln proclaims November 26 as a National Thanksgiving Day, to be celebrated annually on the final Thursday in November. So it's not on the same date every year, but it's on the same day. Following the Franksgiving controversy of 1939 and 1941, it's been observed on the fourth Thursday in 1942 and subsequent years. 1865, Battle of Paputo. Spanish Navy schooners defeated by a Chilean corvette north of Valparaiso, Chile. 1914, the HMS Bork is destroyed by a large internal explosion with the loss of 741 men near Sheerness. 1917, the Manchester Guardian publishes the 1916 secret Sykes-Picot Agreement between the UK and France. 1917, the National Hockey League is formed with the Montreal Canadiens, Montreal Wanderers, Ottawa Senators, Quebec Bulldogs, and Toronto Arenas as its first teams. 1918, the Montenegrin Podgorica Assembly votes for a union of the people, declaring assimilation of the Kingdom of Serbia. 1922, Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon become the first people to enter the tomb of Pharaoh Tutankhamun in over 3,000 years. Lord Carnarvon died mysteriously shortly after that, as did quite a number of other people involved in the opening of that tomb. Howard Carter didn't, for some reason. 1922, The Toll of the Sea debuts as the first general release film to use two-tone Technicolor.
The Gulf Between was the first film to do so, but it wasn't widely distributed. Toll of the Sea was a general release film. 1939, The Shelling of Manila. The Soviet Army orchestrates an incident which is used to justify the start of the Winter War with Finland 4 days later. 1941, Japan's first air fleet departs the Kuril Islands to strike Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. 1942, Yugoslav partisans convene the first meeting of the Anti-Fascist Council for the National Liberation of Yugoslavia at Bihać in northwestern Bosnia. 1942, Casablanca, the movie starring Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, premieres in New York City. 1943, the HMT Rona is sunk by the Luftwaffe in an air attack in the Mediterranean north of Bahia in Algeria. 1944, German V-2 rocket hits a Woolworths shop in London, UK, killing 168 people. 1944, Germany begins V-1 and V-2 attacks on Antwerp, Belgium. 1949, the Constituent Assembly of India adopts the constitution presented by Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. 1950, Korean War. Troops of the People's Republic of China launch a massive counterattack in North Korea against South Korean and UN, United Nations forces. There's the Battle of Chongsun River and the Battle of Chosin Reservoir, ending any hopes of a quick end to the conflict. North Korea had been defeated, but the Chinese came in and reinforced them and continued the war for another 3 years. 1965, France launches Asterix, becoming the third nation to put an object into orbit using its own booster. 1968, Vietnam War. United States Air Force helicopter pilot James Fleming rescues an Army Special Forces unit pinned down by Viet Cong fire. He later gets the Medal of Honor on this date. 1970, Ambassador Terry, Guadeloupe. 1.5 inches of rain fell in a minute, the heaviest rainfall ever recorded. 1977, an unidentified hijacker named Vrilon, claiming to be the representative of the Ashtar Galactic Command, takes over Britain's southern television for 6 minutes. Starts at 5:12 p.m. They never did find out who Vrilon was. 1983, the Brinks Mat robbery. In London, 6,800 gold bars worth nearly £26 million in 1983 dollars are stolen from the Brinksmont vault at Heathrow Airport. 1986, Iran-Contra. President Reagan announces members of what will become known as the Tower Commission. 1986, the trial of John Demjanjuk, accused of committing war crimes as a guard in a Nazi Treblinka extermination camp, starts in Jerusalem. The Israelis have a long memory. 1991, National Assembly of Azerbaijan abolishes the autonomous state of Nagorno-Karabakh, autonomous oblast of Azerbaijan, renames several cities back to their original names. 1998, Tony Blair becomes the first Prime Minister of the UK to address the Oireachtas, the Parliament of the Republic of Ireland. 1998, the Kahana rail disaster takes 212 lives in Kahana, Ludhiana, in India. 1999, a 7.5 magnitude Ambrim earthquake shakes Vanuatu, and a destructive tsunami follows. 10 people were killed and 40 were injured. In the year 2000, George W. Bush is certified the winner of Florida's electoral votes by Katherine Harris, going on to win the United States presidential election, despite losing in the national popular vote. 2003, the Concorde makes its final flight over Bristol, England. 2004, Rizzo School Massacre. A man stabs and kills 8 people and wounds another 4 in a school dormitory in Rizhao, China. 2004, the last Pauli, a black-faced honeycreeper, dies of avian malaria in the Maui Bird Conservatory Center in Olinda, Hawaii, before it could breed, making the species in all probability extinct. 2008, the Mumbai attacks. series of terroristic attacks kill 166 citizens. It's done by 10 members of Lashkar-e-Taiba, Pakistani-based extremist Islamist terrorist organization. Well, let's kill in the name of religion. That'll show Allah we really support him. 2008, the ocean liner Queen Elizabeth II, now out of service, docks in Dubai. 2011, NATO attacks in Pakistan. NATO forces in Afghanistan attack a Pakistani checkpoint in a friendly fire incident. 24 soldiers are killed and 13 are wounded. 2011, the Mars Science Laboratory launches to Mars with the Curiosity rover. 2018, the robotic probe InSight lands on Elysium Planitia Mars. And in 2019, a magnitude 6.4 earthquake strikes western Albania. 52 people are killed and over 1,000 injured. Deadliest earthquake of 2019 and deadliest to strike the country in 99 years. Well, there's a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian feast days. Elpidias, the Stylite. Basilius. Belinius of Padua. Conrad of Constance. Ethelwine of Ethelney. John Birchmans. Pope Syracuse. Salanios of Paphlagonia in the Eastern Orthodoxy. Sylvester Gazzolini. Isaac Watts in the Episcopal Church in the U.S. Constitution Day in Abkhazia and Georgia. Constitution Day in India. And Republic Day in Mongolia. Let's see what else we've got. Isn't that interesting? All right, let's see. Well, I thought Charles Schulz, who did Snoopy, was born on this date in 1922. In 1982, Nakasone Yasuhiro, leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, was elected Prime Minister of Japan. 1941, Cordell Hull, Secretary of State, sent a note to Japan calling for a full withdrawal from China and Indochina. Didn't really work. On this date in 1894, Nicholas II, the last Tsar of Russia, married Alexandra. Pelagius II succeeded Benedict I as Pope on this date in history. On this date in 1895, the Nobel Prize was established. In 2014, P.D. James, the British mystery novelist, became known as the Queen of Crime. She was the one that created the fictional detective Adam Dalgleish of Scotland Yard. She died in Oxford, England. In 1973, the U.S. Senate favored Gerald Ford's succession to the vice presidency. That was his reward for the way he voted on the Warren Commission. In 1942, the French Navy scuttled 73 ships at Toulon. in order to avoid the Germans seizing them during World War II. On this date in 1924, the first Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade was held in New York City. I understand it was one today, though we didn't see it as we usually do. In 1874, Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel and the guiding force behind the World Zionist Organization, was born. In 511, Clovis I, king of the Franks and ruler of much of Gaul from 481 to 511, during the transformation of the Roman Empire into Europe, died in Paris. On this date in 1943, the Tehran Conference, or Tehran Conference, attended by President Roosevelt, Prime Minister Churchill, and Soviet Premier Stalin, started. During that meeting, Stalin pressed for an invasion of France. In 1960, Mauritania declared its independence and left the French community. In 1919, Lady Astor became the first woman to sit in the British House of Commons. Okay. Anything else of interest? On this date in 1582, William Shakespeare married Anne Hathaway. That's assuming Shakespeare really existed. Okay, let's see if there's anything else. This is also National Cake Day. The comic strip Calvin and Hobbes premiered on this date. Okay. In 43 BC, the Second Triumvirate, the alliance of Roman leader Octavian, who later became Caesar Augustus, Marcus Aurelius and Lepidus, and Mark Antony was formed. In 1688, Louis XIV, the Sun King of France, declares war on the Netherlands. 1688, King James II escapes back to London. Well, let's see. 1825, the first college fraternity was founded, Kappa Alpha, at Union College in New York. 1832, the first streetcar railway in America starts operating in New York City. The fare was 12 cents. In 1859, the last weekly installment of Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities is published in the literary periodical All the Year Round. In 1865, Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll is published in America. He was both an author and a mathematician. 1867, the refrigerated railway car is patented by J.B. Sutherland of Detroit. 1896, Amos Alonzo Stagg at the University of Chicago
creates the American Football Huddle. In 1898, the SS Portland, called the Titanic of New England, leaves for Cape Cod, shipwrecked off Cape Ann, and all 192 on board are killed. All right. We finished our history installment. We've been talking about creatures of the night. I've gotten a lot of feedback, wanting more information on various topics. Well, we were talking about vampires and how people look at them. In Nosferatu, it was something you'd want to step on if you saw it. But Anne Rice, vision of identification with the vampires, an acuan for thousands of contemporary men and women. It's been a highly contributive element in establishing an entire subculture of those who want to become bona fide children of the night. In November 24, 2000 issue of the New York Times, Margaret Mittelbach and Michael Crowden report on the city's vampire scene. They say it's been going strong since the mid-90s, and there's a lot of clubs that cater to the daylight challenged, as they call them. You know, the vast majority of those who are captivated by the vampire lifestyle are those young people find dressing the part of an attractive, seductive member of the undead to appeal to their romantic sensibilities. For these individuals, attending a vampire den one night a week may be akin to being able to dress up for Halloween 52 nights of the year. Of course, there's an occasional bit of bloodletting and licking that may be kind of an aphrodisiac and intensify their lovemaking. And men who enjoy emulating the vampire legend as epitomized in the 20th century by the various motion picture Draculas. There's Bela Lugosi, Frank Langella, Christopher Lee, Gary Oldman. They dress in elegant capes and evening clothes as they role play the character, the mysterious and handsome stranger who can promise eternal life and lust to their ladies, who also role play by donning the classic cinematic ethereal gowns with the plunging necklines of the innocent Lucy Westerner, Frances Dale, Kate Nelligan, Barbara Shelley, and Winona Ryder, eager to be seduced by the kiss to the neck that had become bestowed passion upon their beyond their wildest dreams. It's interesting to note that in these games of let's pretend we're vampires, nobody visits these clubs and parties dressed as a hollow-eyed, pasty-faced, grotesque Nosferatu. And while the role-playing as vampires and victims may be considered quite harmless as long as the participants know when to draw the line between fantasy and reality, those men and women who cross the boundaries of mental aberration into blood fetishism and obsessive blood drinking may gradually develop a psychosis that can force them to mutilate or even kill others. According to psychologists, the desire to assume the guise of a vampire, the restless soul of a member of the undead who must drink blood of the living to sustain its life, is highly suggestive of pathologically immature, dependent personalities. Those who can't fend for themselves in a normal business of living, but who have to attach themselves to a more productive personality, just as a vampire attaches itself to those hosts on whose blood it feeds. These individuals almost always subconsciously desire to return to the state of complete dependence, characteristic of the prenatal state. Psychoanalysts often discovered in these pathological cases in which subjects believe themselves to be vampires, the grave or the coffin comes to symbolize the womb. And the vampire's dependence upon the grave or the coffin as a place of safety seems to portray a deep longing for the prenatal security of the womb. Of course, those psychologists who put forth this philosophy, you have to wonder about them. The people could just be nuts. Or, on the other hand, they could actually be vampires. To such students of the mind, the vampire's fangs are clearly phallic, both in form and function.
The vampire predilection for young people and children, often their own relatives, reveals a form of infantile sexuality and possibly incestuous cravings. I've known a few relatives that would excite such cravings. The act of sucking a victim's blood is itself significant, for many psychologists state that such an act will be a sign of a mother fixation, and the fear that one's life will end with somebody driving a stake through one's heart, according to these researches, may well be a hatred of the father figure. Other psychologists call such beliefs by their colleagues drivel. It would appear that the true lair of the vampire must be sought in the hidden and forgotten recesses of the human mind, rather than in secluded burial vaults and cobweb-laced ruins of deserted mansions. And the terrible hunger of real-life vampires must be understood in the light of the frustrations and misdirection of the most basic of human needs: the need to love and reproduce one's own kind. But in addition to the blood-drinking vampires, there are also what are called psychic vampires. Maybe the archetypal vampire are truly those nocturnal demons that have been visiting the resting places of humans for thousands of years, draining the vital fluids and life energies of their victim who lie helplessly under their seductive ethereal forms. These creatures of the dark are known as incubi, who often appear to their female prey as handsome men, and succubi, who manifest as rapturous feminine vessels of delight who receive the seminal fluids of male. Now, there's one school of thought that these creatures, the incubi and the succubi, are in some fashion demonic entities. But there's another type of vampire, equally as deadly as the ones that drain their victims' blood, and they're known as psychic vampires. They steal the spiritual life force from their unsuspecting prey. Now, there's one kind of psychic vampire in nearly every office environment or any setting where a number of humans gather to work or to exchange social amenities. I mean, you've all seen such an insidious siphon of energy at work. Everybody comes into the office trying his or her best to be cheery and upbeat first thing in the morning, but you have one that sits there frowning, matching every greeting with a dour response. By lunchtime, and you've all seen it, what we might refer to as old grandpa's now perky and cheery. But those seated near the vampire are now feeling very low energy, even depressed and down. Once again, this, for lack of a better term, psychic vampire has sucked up all the positive energy it's needed from its office mates, and it's been nurtured and fed, and it's ready to work at full force. The only way to protect yourself from the psychic vampire is to move your desk to the far side of the office, or to practice the mental exercise of shielding yourself by visualizing a barrier of between yourself and the grumpy person. Now, there's a much more dangerous kind of psychic vampire that can select a likely victim and steadily drain the person's life force till that prey has fallen fatally ill, callously leaving the once vigorous individual depleted and lying in a comatose state. The psychic vampire moves on to feed on a new victim's vital energy. Now, one account that I read written by a very spiritually adept metaphysician, it found itself defending a young woman who had fallen prey to such a practitioner of black magic, a psychic vampire. According to what this individual said, everybody at the office loved this young lady. She was a beautiful Hispanic girl in her early 20s, and when she began working, she was just sparkled with energy. After the first few weeks, she became very subdued and quiet, though. And while she'd been outgoing and friendly, she was now withdrawn and nearly indifferent to the responses of others. Where she'd been moving briskly about the office, clearly enjoying herself, she now seemed to be carrying a great weight on her shoulders. When people discussed the change in her personality,
The response was the honeymoon was over and the girl settling down to being a drone on a dental office routine. But this metaphysician believed that the apathy and lethargy had been caused by something much more sinister. He said he had always kept quiet about his interest in metaphysics. Only his closest friends were aware that he had been studying the occult and the paranormal for over 20 years. He said he had become extremely adept at astral projection, that's conscious and controlled out-of-body experience, and he considered himself a rather skilled practitioner of white magic.
Motion detected at the front door.
And unbeknownst to his fellow office workers, he had placed many a healing spell on them and accelerated improvement in their various ills and allergies. Well, he said he had a certain suspicion about one of the department heads for quite some time. He described the department head as a rather stout, middle-aged man in his early 50s who had been there for less than a year. Something about him just didn't feel right, and we've all known people like that. He said he had noticed that certain people felt very uncomfortable in his presence for reasons they could never quite explain. These same people would also often seem to suffer from sudden headaches or upset stomachs. Even occasionally, they had fainting spells. And the metaphysician strongly suspected this individual was drawing energy from him when he needed an extra boost to complete a heavy workload of his own. And on some level of consciousness, he also felt that he was responsible for the young lady's change of personality. He suspected that this department head might be either a conscious or unconscious psychic vampire. But he didn't have any idea about the extent of the man's true powers till one night when he was out of his body during a deep meditative state. He'd been lying, he said, before the altar when he had constructed in the corner of his apartment when he suddenly felt his astral body being pulled to in a certain direction as if it's being sucked into a vortex. Well, he became alarmed, but then he heard a voice telling him he's been taken somewhere to help somebody. He found himself, he said, in a bedroom. A young girl lay on the bed, and he saw the shadowy figure of a man approaching her bedside. For a moment, he thought he was witnessing a thief breaking into a woman's apartment. But then he realized the situation was even more insidious than that. He saw the other man in the room was also out of his body, and he was being given to understand why he had been summoned there by higher powers. The young woman tossing on her bed was the young worker. The shadowy figure was the department head. He said he could hear a small whimper from the young lady as the department head's form hovered over. He knew at once that he was a very powerful magician from the dark side, and that he had visited her before. And the metaphysician perceived he was invading her unconscious mind as she lay sleeping, and he was projecting an image of himself as a handsome young man of great seductive power. Well, the sleeping victim tossed off her cover as if she'd suddenly grown too warm, and the black magician hovered above her like a dark cloud, and the metaphysician became very aware of the mental images of which the department head was bombarding his prey. The young lady moaned as if trying to resist the impressions flooding her unconscious, but the department head, he said, was very clever, a master magician at manipulating somebody who lay in the dream state. He said she sighed and lifted her nightgown, opening her naked legs to receive her unseen exploiter. And that was when he moved to oppose the department head. The unscrupulous dark magician had been draining the young lady's psychic energy by forcing her to have astral sex with him in the dream state. He truly was like a vampire on many levels, and he knew he had to stop him. Well, the department head became aware of someone else's presence and swung about like a hungry wolf prepared to fight for its prey. The metaphysician said he didn't know if he was up to doing psychic combat with a dark side magician, but felt confident that the forces that had brought him there was also standing by to assist him. And then he saw fear come across the face of the department head, and he knew he was correct. Glancing behind him, he said he saw the images of three etheric masters, each one holding flaming swords. The department head beat a hasty retreat, leaving the young lady to awaken, wide-eyed and trembling, as if she had emerged from a nightmare. And at that same instance, the metaphysician felt a tugging at his astral body and knew he was being pulled back to his physical body in his own apartment. He awakened, pleased and able to serve and to assist the White Brotherhood in combating such a powerful magician as that department head. He wasn't at all surprised when he got to the office the next morning to learn that Jeremy had resigned and already cleaned out his desk and vacated the premises. And a short time later, the young lady's health and vibrant spirit were restored to their previous high levels, and she was her old self. So apparently there are levels of consciousness of which most of us are not aware. And then, of course, one story I'm always hearing is that of the chupacabra, also a creature of the night. Although certain purists of monsterdom will insist the chupacabra is but an elder creature of darkness that's been resurrected in our own modern era, it seems to other students that the world has been waiting for a new blood-sucking beast to manifest upon the scene. When the chupacabra first gained notoriety in Puerto Rico in the summer of 1995, it achieved instant popularity and what you might call a creepy type of celebrity status. Named for a seemingly initial penchant for attacking goats and drinking their blood, the chupacabra, which means goat sucker, both terrified and fascinated the public at large. Soon there was a song dedicated to the chupacabras to be sung to the tune of the Macarena, and comedians were coming up with their own translations of the creature's name, such as Dave Barry, who said the word was actually Spanish for attorney, and I would second that. However, for those farmers and ranchers who entered their corrals and pens to find their livestock slaughtered, mutilated, and drained to blood, chupacabra was hardly a laughing matter, or a folk legend to be celebrated in song. From August of 95 to January of 2001, the monster was credited with at least 3,000 deaths of animals ranging from goats and rabbits to birds, horses, cattle, deer. Almost any kind of creature you can imagine fell prey to this creature of the night. Now, according to the stories, the beast is actually nightmarish in appearance. It's observed by numerous eyewitnesses as it attacked their livestock. Many of the first-hand descriptions make the creature seem very much like some kind of miniature bipedal dinosaur minus a tail. Standing erect on its powerful goat-like legs with their three-clawed feet, seizing a helpless sheep in three-clawed hands at the end of its thin arms, the chupacabra could almost be a much smaller version of the Tyrannosaurus rex. Now, this creature is generally described as slightly over 5 feet in height, though some reports listed it as over 6.5 feet tall. Its head is oval in shape. It's got an elongated jaw with a small slit mouth and fangs that protrude both upward and downward, which in certain accounts sounds similar to the grotesque monster in the Alien motion picture series. A few witnesses claim to have seen small pointed ears on its reptilian-like head, but nearly all who've seen the chupacabra state they'll never forget its red eyes glowing menacingly in the dark. Most unusual attribute of the chupacabra is its chameleon-like ability to change colors, even though it appears to have strong, coarse black hair that covers its torso. Somehow, the creature is able to alter its coloration from green to grayish and from light brown to black, depending on the vegetation that surrounds it. And another peculiarity of the beast is the row of quill-like appendages that runs down its spine and the fleshly membrane that extends between those projections, which can flare or contract, and it can also change color from blue to green, from red to purple. Some witnesses who've managed to drive the monster away from their livestock claim the chupacabra can fly. Others state it's the beast's powerful hind legs that merely catapulted over walls, small trees, and one-story barns or outbuildings. And it's those same strong legs that enable the creature to run at extremely fast speeds to escape pursuers. Well, it wasn't long after the night terrors in Puerto Rico before reports of chupacabra began appearing in Florida, Texas, and Mexico. And among the ranchers in Brazil's southern states of Sao Paulo and Paraná. In Brazil, the ranchers called the monster O Bicho, the beast. But there's no mistaking the brutal signature to chupacabras and mutilated corpses of sheep and other livestock began to mount up. The description provided by frightened eyewitnesses was also the same. Reptilian creature with thin arms, long claws, powerful hind legs, and dark gray in color. Well, on May 11, 1997, a newspaper, Folha de Londrina, in Paraná State in Brazil, published the account of a massacre that had occurred at a ranch near Campina Grande do Sul when a single corral, 12 sheep were found dead and another 11 horribly mutilated. While some authorities scoffed at these accounts and attributed the attacks to wild dogs or cougars, other officials who had themselves been eyewitness to the appearance of the beast argued the creature they'd seen walking on its hind legs and seizing livestock by the throat and was most certainly not been any kind of known canine or cat. For one thing, neither dogs nor cats have fangs that are equipped to suck blood from their prey. Well, a number of authorities began to speculate that the chupacabra-type creatures had been manufactured by some secret government agency, a bizarre hybrid of various animals, created for God knew what purpose. Certain clergymen issued pronouncements indicating that God knew very well what the creature was. It was a wake-up call, heralding the end of the world. UFO buffs theorized the monsters had been brought here by extraterrestrial aliens who were using their grotesque pets to test our atmosphere and environmental in preparation for a mass invasion of Earth. Anthropologists asserted that tales of a mysterious vampire-like creature that sucked the blood out of livestock had been common to Central America for centuries. Well, whatever the bloodthirsty creature is, chupacabra, or closely related species, might range into Argentina, Chile, Nicaragua, and other South American nations, but it also continues to attack the farms of Puerto Rico. August 11, 1998, Senora Providencia Rivera Mercado, who lives in the Barrio Playa section of Anasco, found each of her 17 rabbits, 4 guinea hens, and other assorted fowl dead and bloodless from perforations on their neck. Luis Diaz, who resides in the Colinas Verdes section in Calle, a small city about 30 miles south of San Juan, said he had never believed in tales of the chupacabra until Christmas Eve 1998, when he went outside to see a creature with dark-colored fur, long hind legs, short front legs, and a broad body hovering over a number of his chickens. He speculated either the bloodsucker could fly or was capable of extremely high jumps, which vanished almost at once, leaving behind 15 hens, 2 ducks, and a variety of other poultry, all dead and drained of their blood. Well, rumors concerning chupacabra's origin continued to circulate at a furious pace. From April to September 2000, over 800 animals were slaughtered by the bloodsucker in Chile. Both the people and the authorities are becoming concerned about what kind of monster was running amok in their country. Some witnesses to the bloody rampages of the creature described it as a large rodent, others as a mutant kangaroo, others perceived it as a winged ape-like vampire. While the popular story spread throughout Chile that Chilean soldiers captured a chupacabra male, female, and cub that had been living in a mine north of Calama. According to the account, a team of NASA scientists arrived in a black helicopter and reclaimed the chupacabra family. According to the story, the creatures had escaped from a secret NASA facility in the Atacama Desert in northern Chile when the U.S. space agency was attempting to create some kind of hybrid beings that could survive on Mars. Now, if you want to send bloodsuckers to Mars, I suggest we send many of those elected to Congress. On August 30, 2000, Jorge Luis Talavera, a farmer in the jurisdiction of Malparaiso, Nicaragua, had had enough of the nocturnal depredations of chupacabra, laying wait with rifle in hand for its return. The beast had sucked the life from 25 of his sheep and 35 from his neighbor's flocks. That was an average of 4 sheep a night for 15 days, and as far as he was concerned, that was enough. Well, it seemed that Talavera accomplished what no other irate farmer or rancher had been able to do up to that point. He shot and killed a chupacabra. Scott Corrales from the Institute of Hispanic Ufology reports that a specialist of veterinary medicine examined the carcass and acknowledged it was a very uncommon creature with great eye cavities, smooth bat-like skin, big claws, large teeth, and a crest sticking out from the main vertebra. The specimen could have been, according to the specialist, a hybrid animal made up of several species created through genetic engineering. However, on September 5, 2000, the official analysis of the corpse by the University Medical College was that Talavera had shot a dog. Furious, Louis Talavera declared that the officials had switched carcasses. He told folks that what the college was showing wasn't his goat sucker. It wasn't what he had given them. And I would not be surprised if that was not that did not take place. Because the powers that be always want to make sure that you understand there's nothing to see. Moving along. On October 8th, somebody's goat sucker, other vampiric creature from out of the dark, was sighted on a rooftop in Iquique, Chile. Jesus Barrientos, 42, told the newspaper La Corriente he had gone up on the roof about 10:30 in the evening to arrange some boxes stored there. At first, he thought the thing was an extremely large bat, but in the moonlight, he could see it was some kind of strange animal with an elongated face, bulging eyes, and sharp teeth. Well, he just froze in terror and believed the creature was about to jump at him, but then it spread its huge wings and flew off into the night. Well, later on, as he told others about his frightening experience, he found out other residents in the city had claimed to have seen that creature standing on top of the dome of the city's cathedral. I mean, let's face it. What better vantage point could the vampire or bloodsucker have to spot his next victim than standing on top of the dome of the cathedral? Well, let's turn from the chupacabra to what you might refer to as werecreatures. Our first story comes from late one winter's night in 1993. Lorianne Andrizio was driving down Bray Road in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, when she saw what she thought was a man crouching in the side of the road. Curious as to what he might be doing on the shoulder of the road, she slowed down for a closer look. But in the next few minutes, she was astonished to see that the being spotlighted in the beams of her headlights was covered with fur, had a long wolf-like snout, fangs, pointed ears, and eyes that had a yellowish glow. But the creature's arms were jointed like a human's, had hands with human-like fingers that were tipped with pointed claws. Well, rather than stopping, she pressed that accelerator down, sped off, thinking the creature was so human-like it had to be some kind of freak of nature. Later, when she visited her local library, she found a book with an illustration of a werewolf. She said she was startled to see how much the classic monster of legend resembled the beast that she had seen that night on Bray Road right there in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Doris Dean Gibson, another Elkhorn resident who sighted the creature on Bray Road, described it as having a large chest like that of a weightlifter. She was certain she hadn't seen a dog, but a human-like creature that had a wide chest and was covered with long brown hair.
Motion detected at the front door.
A 12-year-old girl said she had been with a group of friends walking near a snow-covered cornfield when she sighted what they believed to be a large dog. When it began to call, it had stood and stared at him. Scared the crap out of him. As the children screamed in alarm, the beast dropped back on all fours and began running toward him. Well, fortunately for the children, at the last minute, the monster headed off in another direction and disappeared. Some area residents believed that the Wisconsin werewolf was a real wolf, and others reminded the concern that bears have the ability to stand on their hind feet and to use their front claws as if they were hands. But according to wildlife expert Don Grubner, neither animal was found in that particular area, so they still don't know what it was. You know, psychologists recognize a werewolf psychosis, lycanthropy, or lupinomanus, in which people so afflicted may believe that they change into a wolf at the full moon. And those so disturbed may actually feel their fur growing, their fingernails becoming claws, their jaws lengthening, their canine teeth elongating. Maybe the werewolf that haunted Bray Road in 1993 was such a demented individual temporarily possessed of a psychosis that eventually passed, allowing mental equilibrium to once again become balanced. Of course, just because some ivory tower scientist can create a name for a psychosis doesn't mean that that's what it is. If, however, the Wisconsin werewolf who stalked the winter wilds between the towns of Elkhorn and Delavan was truly a member of the lycanthropic lineage of legend, then he or she could have easily shapeshifted back into the form of a familiar and trusted citizen of either community. The really upsetting thing about werewolves and other were creatures of ancient tradition is their ability to appear so normal and unnoticed in their human form and their capacity to become so vicious and savage in their animal form. What if in that savagery, such a were-creature as a werewolf should bite you one night during the full moon as you were out walking in the woods? Would you then become a werewolf? Just as in such popular movies as The Wolf Man, The Howling, and American Werewolf in London? Well, you don't have to worry about that. The werewolf didn't leave enough of its victim's body parts scattered about to allow him to become fledgling creatures of the night. According to all the evidence, the werewolf bites, slashes, tears, and devours its victims. There's none of the polite and mannerly vampiric sucking of the victim's neck and leaving two small puncture marks on the throat as kind of an initiation right into the ranks of the undead. There are no seductive promises of a life eternal or everlasting youth and sexual prowess as long as the neophyte vampire is able to subsist on the warm blood of the living. The werewolf is strictly, wham, bam, you're dead. Really dead. Not undead. Unlike the traditional vampire, werewolves are not members of the undead who promise everlasting life and undiminished seductive powers in exchange for a little warm blood. When they're in their human form, they can walk about tranquil forest paths or bustling city streets, appearing as ordinary as anybody on his or her way to work. They don't need to fear the scorching rays of the rising sun. They don't have any need for moldy coffins in which to sleep during the daylight hours. And they don't have a problem with mirrors. Those who become werewolves in the ancient tradition are generally of two types. One, innocent men and women who run afoul of a sorcerer who had vengefully placed a curse on them, which transforms them into werewolves. Or, power-hungry individuals who deliberately sought the ability to shapeshift into the form of a werewolf through an application of dark side magic. Those innocents who become werewolves against their will may have been filled with disgust at their acts of slashing, ripping, and often ingesting the flesh of their human victims, but they seem to be powerless to resist such gruesome and murderous desires while they remain under the spell of what had been placed on them. And those who became werewolves because of their quest for power of transmutation from human to animal through incantation, potion, or spells took evil delight in their savage strength and their ability to strike fear into the hearts of all those that they encountered. So how do you stop a werewolf that's chasing you? Well, you can carry a bouquet of wolfbane. You can put sprigs of garlic in your pockets. Well, according to legend, only a silver bullet can stop a werewolf, so contact a Lone Ranger, get some silver bullets. Well, all the werewolf deterrents that we've heard so much about were imagined by Kurt Siodemach in the 1941 classic The Wolfman. If you remember that movie, it starred Lon Chaney Jr., Evelyn Ankers, and Claude Rains. And since that dramatic presentation, they've been repeated as dogma in every werewolf story from Frankenstein Meets the Werewolf to An American Werewolf in Paris. Even the ancient gypsy folklore repeated by Ms. Ankers, who was the heroine in The Wolfman, was created by Siodemach. Every man who's pure of heart and says his prayers at night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright. Well, on September 2nd, 2000, Kurt Siodemach died at his ranch in Three Rivers, California at the age of 98. Referring to his classic screenplay, he once observed that he'd delineated the character of the Wolfman, or the werewolf, an entity that had haunted people's fantasies for over 2,000 years. But it's not only on the misty moors of Wales where Shadamax set the Wolfman that the tread of the werewolf provokes trembling fantasies and nightmares. There's no known culture on this planet that hadn't at one time or another cowered in fear because of the savage attacks of a nocturnal predator known as a werewolf. Now, in Old English, the prefix were means man. So coupled with wolf, it designates a creature that can alter its appearance from human to beast and become a man-wolf. In French, the werewolf is known as loup-garou. In Spanish, hombre lobo. Italian, lupo manaro. Portuguese, lobazon. Polish, vilkolak. The belief in were creatures goes back to the dawn of humankind. Wherever early human settlements appeared, these half-human monsters also came forth from out of the darkness to steal livestock, abduct women, and devour babies. Native American tribes tell of bear people, wolf people, fox people, and so forth, and state that in the beginning of things, people were as animals and animals as humans. Stories of women that gave birth to were creatures are common among the North American tribal myths. Early cultures throughout the Americas, Europe, Asia, and Africa formed totem clans and often worshiped minor deities that were half human and half animal. Norse legend tells about hairy, human-like beings that lived in the underworld caves and came out at night to feast on the flesh of unfortunate surface dwellers. One of the great mysteries in revealing the true identities of the were creatures lies in determining just where the line of demarcation exists between legendary accounts of hairy monsters devouring human victims from the early historical records of savage human warriors draped in animal pelts slaughtering their human foes. For there's no known nation on the planet that at some time in its evolutionary upward spiral didn't adorn its warriors with the skin of wild animals as an integral element in their preparation for battle. They hoped, of course, the ferocity and strength of the beast would rub off on the warriors. Most often, specifically in the evolving Northern European tribes, the fierce animal of choice was the wolf or the bear. In ancient Scandinavia, the Norse word ufhednar, or wolf cloth, and hair worker referred to the wolf or bear skins worn by the fierce Viking warriors when they went berserk or war mad. It became as vicious animals among their opponents. In the Slavonic languages, the werewolf is called Ukodilak, which translates to wolf hair to wolf skin, once again suggesting the magical transference desired from wearing the skin of a brave animal into battle. In the Middle Ages, large bands of beggars and brigands roamed the European countryside at night, often dressed in wolf skin and howling like a pack of wolves on the hunt. In rural areas of France, Germany, Lower Hungary, Estonia, and other countries, these nocturnal thieves were called werewolves. The old Norwegian counterpart to werewolf is vargulf, literally translates as roguelwolf, referring to an outlaw that separates himself from society. In our own age, we're reminded of Hitler's brutal regiment of werewolves, men who were trained to remove all signs of human compassion from their psychics. Or should we overlook how great the behavior such serial killers as Jeffrey Dahmer, Richard Ramirez, Richard Speck, and all the other Jack the Ripper-type slashers and cannibals resemble the classic attack patterns of the traditional werewolf. And on that note, we're going to stop because we've run out of time once again. We'll be back tomorrow. But until then, you've been listening to Ken Hudnall, and this is the Ken Hudnall Show. So until tomorrow, have a great evening and happy Thanksgiving.